So let's go over this material. Maybe I should ask you some questions. Let's start with Buddhism, see what you remember. Anyone know what the word anicca means and its significance? Anicca? Lola? Not eternal. Yeah, everything in creation is perishing. Huh? What about the word anatma? No soul. And I also take it by then to mean no substance. No soul, no substance. What's the significance of that view? That's supposed to be now the big difference between Buddhism and Mayavad Hinduism. Shankaracharya affirms a soul. Buddhism denies a soul. Right? So when he denies the soul, what does he deny? What do they seem to be denying? Graham? Huh? Well, yeah, well. A little hard to deny consciousness. That was the great contribution of Descartes. How can I deny consciousness? Because who's denying? Great step forward in philosophy. You can't deny consciousness. If you remember what they analyze a person as being composed of five. You remember, anybody remember the word? Huh? Skandhas or khandhas, depending on whether you're speaking Sanskrit or Pali, which means literally heaps.
Heaps?
Heaps, yeah. Five heaps.
Feeling.
Yeah, one of them's feeling, one of them's perception.
Impressions.
Wait a minute, let me get my list.
Impulses.
You're confusing me now, right? Yeah. Perception, samsna, feeling, volitional dispositions, some, impulses, samskaras, right? Vijnana, intelligence or consciousness, and form, right? These are the five skandhas. All these are subjected to the laws of karma. They're going on and persisting in material existence. And the Buddhist meditation, at least as practiced by the southern school, the Hinayana, was to kind of try to analyze in detail all these skandhas introspectively without detecting or seeing anywhere a self. And that's what they tried to do. So these are the five skandhas. And if you look and you see what they mean, by consciousness, for example, because that's the one that we would be the most, that's what we identify with, the soul. We say, yeah, we're not the feelings. We say we have a body, a mind, two bodies, gross body and a subtle body, up to including false ego. And then none of those things are ourselves. But consciousness is the symptom of the presence of soul. But as we saw, Buddha says that consciousness is suffering, of the nature of suffering itself. It becomes disturbed, distorted, diseased, and so on. And so that's what has to go away. So I think what they mean by consciousness is contaminated consciousness. Unpurified consciousness. Consciousness as it's empirically manifest in everyday life. That's what's meant by consciousness.
Perception?
And perception also. Perception is one of the activities of feeling as of the mind. Perception is of the senses. We would put all of those things, I believe, except for consciousness, into the baskets of mind and body, which are not self. Anitya, anitya. Who knows what the Four Noble Truths are? Jagannath Krishnadas, he remembers him from way back when. Was there anyone here who wasn't a Buddhist? Go ahead. Yeah, you went, a couple people. Okay, material life is suffering, yeah. By the way, when we say that, we put material there. The Buddhists don't say material. You know, because life, you know, life means material life. Again, it's that, you know, common sense kind of empirical view. I haven't seen anything else, you know, sort of a thing. Okay, life, material life is suffering.
The cause of suffering is
material desire. They would just say desire, right?
To end suffering, you have to end desire.
Yeah. To end the end of the suffering, we have to end the desire. There's a word that's usually used in this case. I didn't see it actually in this particular translation, but you see a lot in this case the word to extirpate the desire. You know, extirpate, it means to like uproot completely. Extract it without anything left over. Extirpate desires. Go ahead. Yeah, the Eightfold Aryan Path or the Eightfold Noble Path. That's right. Those are the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. That's one, by the way, the one thing that Prabhupada preaches over and over and over again is that desires cannot be extirpated. It's impossible. That our business is to purify the desires. It's not desires that are the cause of our suffering, it's material desires. But desires come from the soul. And therefore, actually, they're not innately material. It's just the expression of them. And we analyze things in a different way. But when they say desires, they mean material desires. And that's all that there is. What question was Buddha responding to when he came out with the utterance, "The Tathagata is free from all theories"? Does anybody remember that context of that one, or what it means? The Tathagata is free from all theories. It has no theories. Lola, you remember?
Reality?
He said,
"No, I don't believe that." He said, "Do you believe there is reality?" He said, "No, I don't believe that."
"Do you believe there is reality and non-unreality?" "No, I don't believe that." "No, I don't." No, there's only four of them. Something exists, something doesn't exist, something both exists and doesn't exist. And it is not the case that something both exists and doesn't exist. That's this fourfold negation that shows up as a standard Buddhist. Whenever you see somebody going through that sequence, an assertion, a denial, the conjunction of the assertion and the denial, and the denial of the conjunction of the assertion and the denial, that's Buddhist. Right. That's their thing, right. So he doesn't believe in any of those things about whether there's a reality or not a reality. Is that what he's being asked about there? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I got my wrong thing here. This is in the second part. Questions which tend not to edification here. Yeah. Yeah, first he asked him, "Is the world eternal?" And he says, "I don't believe it's eternal. I don't believe it's not eternal. I don't believe it's both eternal and not eternal. And I don't believe it's not the case that it's both eternal and not eternal." And then he asks if the saints, I guess, I don't know what they're translating that as, arhats maybe, whether they exist after or before or after death. So all these things, he says, are useless questions. And then he says, "Well, what do you believe?" And he says, I have no theories. I have no theories.
It's actually hilarious to see that.
Yeah, because he doesn't. We don't have any theories here either, by the way. Somebody, I have no theories either. I don't know anything about these things. But Krishna knows, and I repeat what Krishna says, and that's the truth, but I have no theories. Mm-hmm, that's true. Everything in Buddhism is automatically included in Krishna consciousness. And remember, Prabhupada said, the chanting of Hare Krishna is silence. Anybody wants a Zen koan to throw around, we have those too. Huh? He got that. He didn't get that from Prabhupada, though. It's not thunder. And neither is it beyond Vaikuntha or Krishna Loka either. So the Tathagata is free from all theories. Right? What does he know? He knows that everything is temporary and how to get rid of his suffering. That's what he knows. He says. What's his answer to the question, where does the soul go after it dies? Huh? Am I remember? He doesn't say that exactly. Huh? Yeah, where does it's like asking what? Where does the fire go when it goes out? No. It's just extinguished. Well, he says the question doesn't apply. The question doesn't apply.
The question doesn't apply because it doesn't exist in the first place?
Because it says if you're asking about a thing that exists, but the soul isn't a thing that exists to begin with. It's not there to go anywhere. Remember, the Buddha's got this process view of reality, you know, that's behind everything that they teach. So for them, the nirvana is just the cessation. I guess nirvana literally means blowing out, or the cessation of material existence. You know, these skandhas are going on, being held together by karma and desire. And when all desire is gone, they break up. Yeah, they would just say cessation of existence. Because by existence, by definition, to them means material existence. Where else have we seen that? That existence means material existence. And therefore, of the highest truth, you have to deny existence. No, the Nirvishesha, they say God. They say there's Brahman. They don't deny existence of Brahman.
The soul.
As an individual, but the Atma exists. It's just that it's wholly identical in every respect with Brahman. But it's like Tilak. God is not a being, you know. And these other people too, beyond existence. You cannot say it's an existent thing because everything derives its existence from them. You see that in Plotinus. You see it in, they want it, it transcends the categories of existence. So the most pious thing you can say about God is he doesn't exist. As soon as you say exist, you've dragged him down to our level. Right? That's what they're saying. So this is the philosophy of negation. Okay, any other questions about this Buddhism stuff? Huh? Well, you know, what is the Eightfold Noble Path? Go ahead, tell us. If you've learned it, you might as well show off your knowledge.
No,
you don't know it? I don't know the Eightfold Noble Path either. Yeah, I've forgotten. It starts off with right livelihood and ends up with right meditation sequence.
You want to know if we should
know? I should not. I'm not going to ask you. You're not Buddhist, so you don't have to know it.
What is the philosophy of that each second is like there's explosions of happenings and
yeah. Yeah, well, basically, the Buddhist philosophy, what they get from this no soul or no substance, is that basically the dharmas, the ultimate units of reality, which they call dharmas, are like little temporal atoms. They're little unit events. And so what I say is my consciousness is not one thing that is conscious. It's just a series of these little events taking place, one after another, that's in a whole network and web of relationships of other events. It's like the philosophy of Heraclitus a little bit. You know, you can't step into the same river once. He said twice, but then somebody pointed out you can't do it once either. I mean, because everything's flowing and changing. So there's no substance. It's not like in a series of events, there's some underlying, unchanging substance of soul. It's just these events. And when a string of them are sufficiently like each other, then it looks like you have a thing. But you really don't have a thing. You understand? Yeah, it's dependent origination. It's part of the whole philosophy of dependent origination. There are metaphysicians in the West that came upon this process of view of reality, Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne. There's a whole school of process metaphysicians and theologians, who, by the way, meet with Buddhists all the time to try to work out their common ideas. So some idea basic like this. Very, very complicated when you get into it, and huge metaphysics and structures have been erected on it. But that's the basic idea. These dharmas are unit events, temporal atoms.
What is dependent origination called in the Sanskrit?
Well, it's derived from this. When this notion of where, you know, how the living entity sort of gets entangled. Well, I slip right back into our own language. It's not really right. But, you know, on ignorance depends karma, on karma depends consciousness. So that's a series it's an analysis of the conditions of being. So from this, and from other analyses of breaking things down, they really get into it. You know. How we saw how the so-called soul is broken down into little units, five different kinds of things, and those are broken down further. And then the Buddha's, the external world, that's also broken down in different ways. Anyway, we didn't really get into that, and if you want to someday, you can, I suppose. But, huh? Yeah, I think so. I think he could almost start anywhere. The Buddhists get really into this stuff. It gets very proficient. You know, I didn't get into it in reading some of the descriptions of these things that they do. But I brought this book for something else. I'll read it later. Anyway, let's just go on here and review Mr. Plotinus, since you brought his name up. So in Plotinus' system, what is the ultimate highest principle? In Buddha, it's nirvana. What is it in Plotinus? What's it called? Yeah? The good or the one. The good or the one. So how does this this one kind of unfolds itself in a series of what are they called, those things that come out of the one? He's got a hypostases. Yeah, right. So who knows what they are? The hypostases that come out of the one.
I thought there was different.
No, they're called, each one is called a hypostasis, and No, you don't get material nature till you're down below the soul, world soul. I've given away. What's the first thing that comes out of the one?
Intelligence.
Yeah. How does it come out? He says in this essay, it dares succession. I don't know how that happened. That's what he said. It sort of boldly took a step out into a decrease in being. I mean, you know, anyway. Remember, these represent levels of being. When you're in the one, you're in the highest reality. And then as you go further away, there's introduction of more and more multiplicity and duality, and therefore loss of being.
But one doesn't
have being. Huh? But the one itself is so far beyond, yet doesn't really have being as we know it here, anyway. This is great science fiction. You know, I've always appreciated metaphysics as kind of the highest form of science fiction. I always remember, you know, think of, you know, Captain Kirk and Dr. Spock, you know, in the Enterprise going up through the intelligence. What's that? You know, there's the intelligence, you know. Anyway. Then there's the word. What is the intelligence? Anybody give a capsule description of what they mean by?
Ideas.
Yeah, it's the realm of the Platonic ideas, which are related to each other in a kind of some structure of unity. They're one but many at the same time. And he used the example, I gave the notion of this idea of, you know, in mathematics and logic, you have the notion of logical equivalence. So you can get that kind of a structure. This means that A implies B and B implies A. So they're one and the same thing. A says John is a bachelor, and B says John is unmarried. So they're really just two different ways of saying the same thing. So somewhere up there in the realm of the ideas, you have the ultimate structure of the ultimate, you know, seed notions, the seeds of the universe, which is some, I don't know how many there are. You could reduce them down further and further, I guess, until you get to the one is in the middle of this thing. Right? Something like that is going on in Plotinus. That's what he envisions up there in the intelligence. And these produce, you know, gradually it unfolds and produces. Anyway, the prototypes for the whole world is in here, all the world of the absolute, you know, the essential cow, the essential dog, everything is in here. All the seeds of diversity in some way, but contained and interspersed with one another. Then there's out of that, what's the next thing that comes out? World soul. What is the world soul? Hi, I'm the world soul. The demiurge, yeah. Like Brahma, the creator. And he takes these, he has a vision of the intelligence and the world of the ideas, and he imposes, using them, he imposes form on the next emanation down, which is matter. Also the individual souls, and it's not clear to me exactly how the souls and the matter come out, but they do. Probably in another essay it's described, I've forgotten. The world soul? World soul, it comes to, the idea comes from Plato. And in Plato's Timaeus, there's an entity called a demiurge. And it's the first, you would have to say, just like we say, first created being. Like an active being who creates the world, creates the cosmic order, He's the creator God. But he's not the ultimate. He looks up higher to the intelligence and the one. He's fairly low down on the transcendental pecking order, actually. So he's like Lord Brahma. Yeah, but he's lower than intelligence. Uh-huh. Although intelligence is not a person, the world soul appears to be an individual. Right? So here on page 77, if you look at Plotinus, you come to a description of the One. The One is not a being because it is precedent to all being. There's our great, you know, transcendental non-existence. Somehow it is, but you can't think of it as is. I mean, otherwise, what are we talking about? You know, you understand where I am? Page 77 on this. Middle four. Wow, there you go. 1, 2, 3, 4. The One then is not the intelligence, but higher. The intelligence is still a being, while the One is not a being, because it is precedent to all being. Precedent means it precedes, it goes, comes before. Being has, you might say, the form of being. Remember, by form, he means the Platonic, you know, idea that participates in something called being. This is where this being itself, you see, comes from. This is where Tillich gets that. Because, you know, Plato talks about the forms as beauty itself, goodness itself. Beauty itself is not a beautiful thing, but it's just beauty in and of itself. So then being itself is not a being. That's where it comes from. If you can't understand it, it's okay. Yeah.
I heard a devotee use an argument which seemed very similar to this, so I didn't get a chance to discuss it with him. He said, God cannot be material because God created matter. And therefore, since he created matter, he could not have any matter in him because he existed before matter.
What do you think about that argument? Does he create spirit too? You know, I think it's not, huh? It doesn't create matter either. It's also eternal, huh? No, you've got to be careful. You can use non-shastic arguments if you want, if you can, if they work, but you have to be careful. Yeah. I wouldn't use that argument. Anyway, it doesn't create matter. There is no, from Krishna's point of view, there's no such thing as matter. From Krishna's point of view, everything is spirit. They're just varieties of spirit. That's Prabhupada explained to me. It doesn't really... because the idea of matter is the idea, it's an illusion that arises with the notion that something is separate from Krishna. What we call the material world is just that place in the spiritual world where that illusion is permitted. But as soon as things are used in Krishna, the illusion of matter disappears. Yeah?
What, in this hierarchy of Plotinus, where does being come
in? Being is not a, one of the hypostasis. Being includes everything except the One.
Intelligence has.
Yeah, intelligence has being, world soul has being, they all have being. Yeah, because they are things. Yeah, they're contingent on the One, they depend on the One. Right. So being, but it, being is just another way of saying, you know, everything that is. So being has, you might say, the form of being. The One is without form, even intelligible form. I said by form he means this idea of a of a free-floating essence. As the one, now here's his big principle, as the one begets all things, it cannot be any of them. He's got this notion in here about causality that it's quite different from Veda Vyasa's. Neither thing, nor quality, nor quantity, nor intelligence, nor soul, not in motion, not at rest, not in space, nor in time. It's proceeding without form, preceding form, movement and rest, which are characteristics of being and make being multiple. So there's this kind of essential little statement there, all those negations. I want to say that because it creates them, it cannot be them. That's what he wants to say. Because I guess his notion is that you know, if he had those things, then it wouldn't be creation. But where they come from, you know, you can't give what you have. When Shankara follows the principle, of course, that the causes have to exist. I mean, the effects have to exist in the cause. And he takes that right on down the, takes it ultimately to mean that there aren't any effects when he finishes working it out. But here he wants to say that, you know, where they come from is also not answered here. So, anything else in here? That
you say that we say that that the one is a cause, the one is not a cause. Then we introduce the idea of causality. It says that we introduce the principle of causality as we perceive the thing. The one is.
Yeah, that's right. Then he goes on and denies that. That's right. You notice that on the page of 78. Let no one object that something is contingent is attributed to the one when we call it the first cause. That is to say, in order to be the first cause, it would depend upon having products. So it would be dependent upon something else. 77, 78, top of 78. It is to ourselves that we are thereby attributing contingency, because it is we who are receiving something from the one, while the one remains self-enclosed. And how do we know it? By a presence transcending knowledge. That's also on 78. And here you get this negative theology coming up. We must renounce knowing and knowable, every object of thought, even beauty, capital B, meaning the idea of beauty. Because beauty too is posterior to the one and derived from it as the sun, the daylight, and so on. Yeah, it's where it shows up. Mm-hmm.
So,
that's in 78. Section 4, second paragraph. Right there. Anyway, that's kind of the essential thing that Plotinus is telling us. Here's his famous phrase at the end, the flight of the lone to the alone. People always see that. Oh, and notice on page 87, if I can go back a little bit, his description of unity or the vision of the one is not seen, not distinguished. 87, first full paragraph there. Actually, we should not say he will see, because the one is not seen, not distinguished, not represented as a thing apart. The man who obtains this vision becomes another being. He ceases to be himself, retains nothing but himself. Then it's all one. Only when they separate can you then talk about having had a relationship with the one. Any other questions about Plotinus? Ignorant of anything, yeah. Being with itself, it does not need to know itself. Excluded from it are both thinking of itself and thinking of others. It is not like that which thinks, but rather like the activity of thinking. It is the cause that has some other being. The activity of thinking does not think itself. It is the cause that has some other being think, and cause not cannot be identical with effect. The cause, therefore, of all existing things cannot be any one of them. Yeah. But he says, because it is the cause of good, it cannot then be called the good. Although he does call it the good. Now, when we go to Dionysius, what's his reasoning for saying that you can give names to this nameless thing? Yeah, because it's the cause. We call it good because it's the cause of good. We call it wise because it's the cause of wisdom. We call it just because it is the cause of justice. And we call it cause because it's the cause of cause. But wait a minute. And then you run into some problems here, as Stakes points out. This is Dionysius. We all want to move on here. He says, if you see on page 138, this is where he says his doctrine of the divine names. He says, these mysteries we learn from divine scriptures, and thou wilt find that in well-nigh means almost, all the utterances of the sacred writers, the divine names refer in a symbolical revelation to its beneficent emanations. 138, beginning with chapter 1. In other words, any name that's attributed to God is not really denoting God, but something that God produces. You know, that's his. So, because he's the cause of good, we call him good. Etc. But this gets you to a problem, because otherwise everything has to be denied. Literally speaking, everything has to be denied. Including words like cause. So you tend to get back into Shankara's position. And you get the one alone without any relationships. And it's implicit there in Plotinus. Here we see a love for contradictory speech, dazzling obscurity. To describe, and what's the word he uses for knowing? Unknowing, yeah, with a capital U, unknowing. Unknowing. Unknowing with a capital U. He means, what does he mean by unknowing? Who wants to explain? Here it is, bottom of page 136. By rejection of all knowledge, one possesses a knowledge that exceeds his understanding. Or just higher mystical intuition. Plotinus says the same thing. You have to become beyond the, beyond any kind of reason. Yeah, the darkness of unknowing. Now, there's a certain phrase that shows up all the time that he uses to express the transcendence of this entity above any kind of created thing. Anybody remember this characteristic expression? Yeah?
Super-essential.
Yeah. Super-essential. Super-essential reality. Which he means beyond the Platonic forms. See, Plato at least thought that, you know, there was a form of the good, a form of, that was the ultimate, was a essence. But here it's beyond essence. Which means it's, you know, utterly totally, 100% incomprehensible. Super essential. You see this show up. A super essential reality. While it possesses, I'm reading the page 135, all the positive attributes of the universe, being the universal cause, yet in a stricter sense, it does not possess them. That's his doctrine of causality again, including the attribute of causality, since it transcends them all. 135, 136. Let me point out to you on the 137, chapter 2. Unto this darkness, this is very characteristic language, that is, which is beyond light, we pray that we may come and may attain unto vision through the loss of sight and knowledge. That whole passage is real typical. And then in chapter 5, we get all our neti, 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 netis lined up in a row for everybody very nicely. Okay, that's Dionysius, the great mystic. We mentioned, remember how he became a big influence over the church because they thought these were written by the disciple of St. Paul. Turns out not to be the case. So we got to move along quickly here. Meister Eckhart. Some characteristic notions of Meister Eckhart or phrases that we run across. How does he describe what he uses certain earthy kind of metaphors to describe the ultimate reality. What are those words? Desert, wilderness, waste, barren desert, right? And he uses two terms to distinguish this desert from the more commonly known features of transcendence. Yeah, there's God, and there's the Godhead. So in his idea that God represents the Trinity, is the traditional Trinity of Christian thought, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, but the unity of the Trinity, which unity these three are a revelation, is the Godhead. And this is where you get this first notion showing up, clearly spoken of God, beyond God, you know. Tillich is really getting all this stuff from here. He doesn't want to say he's a mystic because he wants everybody to stay in the Lutheran church, but that's where it comes from. He uses another metaphor for the mystical experience. Anybody remember what that is? No, that's the last one. That's Dionysius. No. Yeah, the birth of the Son in the soul. The birth of the Son in the soul. Okay. What do we do after that? Now we should. Our memories should need. Oh, St. John of the Cross. What's St. John's? What example does he use to describe mystical union? Union, mystical dreaming, mixing up with California dreaming, huh? Yeah, the example of a ray of light passing through glass. The point of the example is that the glass shines just like the light, but it doesn't become light, it remains glass. So that we become indistinguishable from God for all practical purposes, but that actually we remain separate. Right, that's St. John's example. What else do we do? Then Paul Tillich, you just should remember, you know, God is not a being, but being itself, and all that kind of stuff. And then Huxley, we just went over. I wanted to read you something, just to let you know how these things come together. This is a passage from, you know, a standard textbook in Buddhism by one of the standard authors. So he's been trying to explain a nirvana, and he's answering the question, is Buddhist atheistic? And here we'll see he brings in, you know, some of the things we've been discussing. He says, if indifference to a personal creator of the universe is atheism, then Buddhism is indeed atheistic. We are, however, nowadays, if only through the writings of Aldous Huxley, familiar with the difference between God and Godhead. Right? In other words, Meister Eckhart, as popularized by Aldous Huxley. We are familiar with the difference between God and Godhead as an essential feature of the perennial philosophy. When we compare the attributes of the Godhead, as they are understood by the more mystical tradition of Christian thought, with those of Nirvana, we find almost no difference at all. It is indeed true that Nirvana has no cosmological functions, doesn't create the world, doesn't, you know, cause anything, doesn't, nothing in relationship to the world, no cosmological functions, and that this world is not God's world in Buddhism, but a world made by our own greed and stupidity. It is indeed true that through their attitude, the Buddhists express a more radical rejection of the world in all its aspects than we find among many Christians. At the same time, they are spared a number of awkward theological riddles and have not been under the necessity to combine, for instance, the assumption of an omnipotent and all-loving God with the existence of a great deal of suffering and muddle in this world. So anyway, this is a little kind of comparative passage. So you notice how, like, just these things that we've looked at all come together. Meister Eckhart, Huxley, Nirvana. And this is the framework out of which most people who are at all into Mayavada philosophy are familiar with, to some extent. So that's the idea, so we can know this stuff and know where people are coming from. And now that you've read some of this, you'll see it. You'll start to notice it everywhere. People will notice the distinction about God and Godhead without even knowing that it comes from Meister Eckhart, for example. They don't know where it's all come from. Because you see, popularizers like Huxley have really made it widely available to everybody. The 50 cents for a book or whatever. Okay, so we'll meet tomorrow. Kessler? We didn't do Kessler, that's right. Forgot about him. And here's Prahladananda Swami.
So we have the true way back to
God. Huh? What's that?
To go to God.
Yeah, that's right. Prabhupada uses that phrase, interestingly enough. He said, then we're going back to Godhead, then we're on the right direction, since Godhead is above God. Well, yeah, I didn't get a chance to go over Kessler. With Kessler, you just read it over. It only takes 2 minutes, it's short. Okay, Toy Suda Prabhupada.